Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where long-term performance is driven by original, fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
15 bankers and the President of the United States were together in one room today. What happened at their meeting kind of turned into a game of he said, he said. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Palm Wonderful, 100% pomegranate juice, in the curvy bottle, the antioxidant superpower. Information at pomwonderful.com. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It's Friday, the 27th of March. Glad you could be with us. Although, it might have been more interesting to be sitting in the Oval Office today. President Obama had a sit-down with the guys he needs to help get the country out of this recession, also known as Big Wall Street bankers. CEOs from JPMorgan Chase, Citigroup, Bank of America, and a dozen others were at the White House today. The president asked for the meeting as an opportunity to try to find some common ground. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports from Washington that it was an opportunity for the bankers, too.
The meeting was meant in part to be a kumbaya moment, and if you believe the bankers, it was.
The basic message is we're all in this thing together.
We're delighted that he brought us into the White House to talk about this economy.
But behind all those smiles is a festering wound. Bankers have been beaten up over executive compensation. Did the president use this meeting to voice the American people's frustration? Here's White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs.
Also discussed were issues of compensation and the importance of recognizing what the American public is going through.
Doesn't seem like Richard Davis of U.S. Bank was at the same meeting.
Executive compensation was not part of the discussion.
Either way, bankers are hoping this high-profile visit with a popular president will help them shed their thorny image. Charles Gabriel of Capital Alpha Partners says President Obama seems willing to play along in return for the help he needs from the banks.
Obama's trying to lock the banks into committing to make the public-private investment funds work, while perhaps asking banks to tread carefully in withdrawing from TARP.
In other words, the president wants the banks to sell their toxic assets, excuse me, legacy loans, for less than they think they're worth. And he still wants as many banks as possible to take TARP money to shield the ones that really need it.
But it all starts with stopping the demonization of the banking industry CEOs. So bankers seemed very relieved as they exited the White House.
Relieved, but maybe not entirely satisfied. The president appears to have passed on the usual photo op with his potentially toxic visitors. Perhaps we're all in this together will take a little getting used to. In Washington, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
If you looked only at the stock markets this week, you might have thought better days will soon be upon us. Until today, the major indices were having quite the rally. But as is often true with Wall Street, what you see doesn't reflect all there is. Equities have indeed been on a tear, but that optimism hasn't held true at all in the bond markets. It is still every bit as expensive to borrow as it was before stocks bounced. From New York, Ashley Melentite reports.
If you want to compare the markets to people, the stock market's a bit like a teenager, a short-term thinker who's easily influenced. The bond market, on the other hand, is a much more sensible type with a few gray hairs. Bill Schmick is an investment advisor with Dion Money Management.
A bond, for the most part, is going to attract someone with a long, long-term view. Simply because when you think of a bond, you think of 10-year, 20-year, 30-year bonds.
He says unlike many stock investors, bondholders lock up their money for such long periods they dig deep into the finances of their chosen companies.
Bond players basically have to be shown. Show me the money. Show me the numbers.
They're not happy about the numbers they're seeing now. Marilyn Cohen is president of Envision Capital Management.
Basically, the bond market has seen massive amounts of downgrading. We are already seeing a ton of bankruptcies by corporations, and there's going to be many, many more.
That's depressing confidence in the economy, she says, and pushing investors to demand sometimes painfully high interest rates.
There have been companies that have been, you know, maybe a triple B plus below A rated, and they have had to pay, you know, anywhere between 8 to 9%.
The more interest those companies have to pay out, the more difficult it is to grow, to hire, and even to operate. Cohen says the financial mess began with the credit markets. She says we shouldn't celebrate until they recover. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Slowly but surely, the stimulus money is making its way out of Washington. Before it goes, though, there are a whole lot of lobbyists in town who want to weigh in on how it's spent. $787 billion will do that to you, I suppose. But the White House wants no such thing. Lobbying firms are crying foul. They say the ban violates their right to petition the government, something about the First Amendment, and they are planning a challenge. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has the story.
Both Barack Obama and John McCain campaigned last year on limiting lobbyists' influence. And now the White House has decided that registered lobbyists may not talk to agency officials, either by telephone or in person, about stimulus projects.
It's very dangerous ground that the president's trampling on right now.
Dave Wenhold is president of the American League of Lobbyists.
I think personally it's discrimination, segregation, and unconstitutional against a class of Americans who are just trying to do their jobs.
But the rule still allows lobbyists to submit comments in writing. William Luneberg is a law professor at the University of Pittsburgh who helped to edit the lobbying handbook for the American Bar Association. He doesn't see any free speech violations in the administration's new rules.
The governmental officials are saying, we want to listen directly to the client. We don't want spin put on this. We don't want political influence staring us in the face in the form of a lobbyist. And after all, it's the clients that have the substantive interest they're bringing before the agency. The lobbyist is their mouthpiece.
A recent Harris poll shows some 80% of Americans think lobbyists are too influential. Lobby groups vow to fight this in court, but it may not be the end of restrictions on lobbying contacts with the executive branch. The Treasury Department is said to be drawing up similar rules for recipients of bank bailout money. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders couldn't quite keep up the momentum they've had all week. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Reporting that helped send the city's mayor to jail won the Detroit Free Press a journalism prize today, the National Headliner Award. The story will probably be mentioned in the paper tomorrow, along with a reminder to home subscribers that starting next week, they're going to have to get their copies somewhere other than on their front porch. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports that both Detroit papers have decided fewer readers may be a good thing.
The Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press say they're the first papers in the nation to limit home delivery to Thursdays, Fridays, and Sundays. Those 3 days now draw 80% of the advertising dollars. The papers will be available only at newsstands the rest of the week. Rich Harshbarger is with the Detroit Media Partnership, which runs the business side of both papers.
Someone's got to be first in the water, and with other newspapers in major metropolitan cities closing, filing bankruptcy, going only digital, we know that we have to do something.
Limiting home delivery will save on paper, ink, and fuel. But Bill Mitchell with the Poynter Institute says the papers are rolling the dice with reader loyalty.
The fundamental question is, will breaking the 7-day habit of readers undercut the business model?
Columnist Bill McGraw has been with the Free Press for 32 years. He says the newsroom is ready to embrace its digital future.
I think I've heard more than once that this would be an exciting time if our livelihoods weren't at stake.
I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
An optimist would say we turned a corner this week. The Treasury Department finally shared its plans to save the financial industry and write new regulations for it. There were some economic reports that were more good than bad, and the stock market had a nice bounce. Here to help us do the weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond, emphasis on Beyond this week, I think, are Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine and Felix Salmon. He blogs at Portfolio.com. Good to talk to you guys again.
Great to talk to you.
Good to be here, Kai.
All right, Felix, you go first this week. Fixing the banks. Secretary Geithner's plan out on Tuesday. Yes or no?
No.
All right. Thank you very much, Lee.
There you go. That's my...
Well, I would say, I mean, it's a plan. It was obviously well received. You could argue a little bit with maybe over exuberance that the reaction in the stock market on Monday when the news came out surprised, I think, me and a lot of people. But, you know, it's a plan. The banks need to burn down these losses. This is an idea for doing that.
What I hear you saying is better than nothing.
Yes, but there's a lot that needs to happen for this to work. Investors are getting a fabulous deal here. The government's putting up most of the risk. But we don't know, A, if the investors that do ultimately come forward and make these purchases, if that's going to be enough. The banks not only have to get rid of these bad assets, but they have to have enough of a capital cushion to prevent and absorb future losses. And then you're really asking private investors to be a partner with the government, and there may be some resistance to that.
Right,
so,
right.
You know, there's some risk.
That's a whole lot of I don't knows. Felix, here's your chance to expound on your earlier response.
There's vastly more I don't knows than that. I mean, for one thing, no one has a clue what any of these things are worth. No one has a clue how especially the big four banks are going to, A, be persuaded to participate in this and actually sell their toxic assets, while at the same time, B, making sure that they don't cooperate with each other and game the system. There's so many things which can go spectacularly wrong with this, it's quite astonishing. Yet, it is actually, believe it or not, better than nothing, and it could well be the only thing which was politically feasible in this.
Yeah, I guess that's my point. I mean, for all the I don't knows and nobody has a clue, people have been screaming for him to do something, and here he did something, right?
Absolutely.
Well, people have been expecting him to do something ever since he came out a couple of months ago and said, I'm going to do something. And people were just waiting to see what on earth it was. Once you've announced that you're going to do something, you have to do something. And this is something.
Same guy, different topic. Lee, the bank regulation plan that came out yesterday. Again, Geithner doing something?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think there's widespread agreement by everybody that more regulation is needed and that more regulation is going to happen. He gave some details. Some people question the timing. Why talk about this right now when we're still in the middle of a crisis? You could also argue that now is the time to bring all this up because people are desperately aware that we really need to do something and maybe there'll be more support.
Felix, what do you think? Is it doable what he's proposing?
Yes, I think if it's ever going to be doable, it's doable now. And what he's doing in the first instance is just setting up a new super regulator, which is probably going to be the Federal Reserve, which is going to look at the entire financial system. And rather than, like the SEC, just try and check the box to see whether people are obeying the law, and as long as it's legal, you can go away and do as much as you like, it's really going to look much more critically at companies like General Electric or AIG and say, are you posing a systemic risk? And if you are, then we're going to regulate you very tightly. I think that's a great idea.
All right, so let's go from the substantive to the moderately less substantive. Has Tim Geithner saved his job in the past week?
Yes, he has. Amazingly. And that is entirely thanks to the stock market, which happened to go up that day rather than down. If the stock market had gone down that day, then he would be very, very precarious position. And it's ridiculous that he's at the mercy of something as stupidly volatile as the stock market. But that's unfortunately the case.
Yeah. Lee, what do you think?
I don't think his job was as in jeopardy as others might have thought. I mean, Obama came out loud and clear and said, no, absolutely not. I'm behind him. If he offered his resignation, I would not take it. But I definitely think he improved his public image enormously this week. Now, he still has a long way to go. A lot of stuff still has to happen, both in terms of the stress test that we're going to put on these banks and then to see whether the public-private partnership works.
Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine. Felix Salmon blogs at Portfolio.com. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up, Iceland tries to find something else to bank on.
We can be self-sufficient with energy. We don't have to spend a lot of valuable foreign currency to import fossil fuels. Of course, that will have a big impact on the economic life of Iceland. And that's the beautiful future.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials dropped 1.8% today, 148 points, closed at 7,776. The NASDAQ fell 2.6%, 41 points, finished at 1545. The S&P 500 lost 2%, 16 points, ended the day and the week at 815. For the week gone by, the Dow gained nearly 7%. Both the NASDAQ and the S&P rose roughly 6% apiece. The oil patch came under pressure today as crude fell below $53 a barrel. Schlumberger fell more than 7%. Hess dropped more than 8%. Exxon lost 1.75%. KB Home rose more than 6% today, despite reporting a larger-than-expected loss in the quarter. Lennar Homes reports next week. It fell 0.1% today. D.R. Horton ended down roughly 1% on this Friday. Tech consulting firm Accenture reported a loss, fell 13%, but General Motors climbed 6% on news that it's hired advisors to sell its Opel unit over in Europe. Bond prices rose. When that happens, yields fall, and in this case, the 10-year T-note fell to 2.76%, and you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Let us do the work for you. Download Marketplace's After the Bell, a podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, climate change experts gather to discuss America's climate choices at a two-day summit hosted by the National Academy of Sciences. The 8th World Conference on Sport and the Environment continues in Vancouver, and an opportunity to get up close to a spacecraft, sort of. NASA's full-size mock-up of the Orion crew moon exploration vehicle will be parked on the National Mall for a day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. 30 years ago tomorrow, a valve inside a nuclear power plant near Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, got stuck. And the world learned more than it ever wanted to know about a place called Three Mile Island. It was the worst accident in the history of commercial nuclear power in this country. Nothing here has come close since. But the idea of a nuclear plant in the backyard still makes a lot of people uneasy. People have been wary of uranium, the main nuclear fuel, for centuries now, all because of what happens inside its tiny, unstable nucleus. Tom Zollner's got a new book out on the topic called, what else? Uranium.
It was regarded in the Middle Ages as mineral garbage. It was found in the silver mines, and when they came across it, the silver miners of the Middle Ages, it meant that that was the end of the silver, and so it was a portent of ill fortune. And it was only in the 1930s when this collective realization began to dawn among scientists in European and American universities that there was something really important going on inside that nucleus that could be harnessed.
And in fact, actually, it was that you could split that nucleus, right?
Correct. And with the lightest of touches, with what amounts to a little pinprick, just the introduction of a neutron will break apart the binding energy that holds that nucleus together and shatter it with tremendous force.
And eventually it becomes the centerpiece of what is arguably the largest industrial operation ever known to man, right? The Manhattan Project and the building of the atomic bomb.
And that was all about uranium. That was all about enriching the uranium. And what that means is you're stripping away the most fissile part of uranium, the U-235. You're separating that kind of like cream from butter. And that's a very difficult thing to do. And this cost, during World War II, $2 billion. We essentially created a series of secret cities across the continent to do this enormous industrial project.
How, after the Second World War, and after we realized the power and the problems that come with uranium, how did that market develop?
Well, something really extraordinary happened. In the United States, we saw it as a strategic imperative to get a hold of it, as much of it as possible. And in particular, as much of it as possible on the American continent so that we wouldn't be dependent on foreign supplies. And so the Atomic Energy Commission gave these fantastic bonuses for prospectors and miners to go out to the American Southwest and dig up as much of it as they could. This amounted to the last kind of gold rush in American history. And on the other side of the planet, the Soviets were up to the same thing.
Hmm. Do we know how much enriched uranium is out there, has been produced in the last 70 years?
Remarkably, no.
Well, if we don't know how much is out there, and we sort of know what demand is, right? Because anybody who wants to build a nuclear weapon of any kind probably wants to get their hands on uranium. If we don't know what the supply part of that curve is, and we do know what demand is, how do you figure out what the price is? I mean, what does that market look like today?
This is a really fascinating market, and talk about volatility. We've seen the price go up to $135 a pound. It's tied to perceptions of supply and demand. It's tied to, most importantly, the prognosis for the worldwide enthusiasm for nuclear power. And now with the president giving a signal that the United States is not going to rely on nuclear power as a short-term energy solution, this price is most likely going to drop further.
Assuming there is no support from the Obama administration for loan guarantees for new nuclear power plants and that kind of thing, what do you suppose the future of the uranium market is, at least in the short term?
Dismal. Wall Street has consistently refused to finance the construction of new nuclear power, and this has been the reality since the early 80s. The argument from the nuclear industry is this is a great national endeavor to save ourselves from climate change. There's a lot of critics of that argument, of course, but this is the current line of reasoning.
The book by Tom Zollner is called Uranium. Tom, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Last week, the people of Iceland got the first good bit of economic news they've had in months. Interest rates went down from 18% to 17%. Clearly, the country is still in deep and serious trouble. Iceland's biggest banks went spectacularly bust last October. Today, the real estate market is frozen. Car sales are down 80%. Unemployment is close to record highs. So Icelanders are casting around for new ways to earn a living. From Reykjavik, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
After the glamour of high finance, this may sound like a bit of a letdown. Iceland's newest business, a shop selling second-hand clothes for young kids. It's the first of its kind in this country, a clear sign of tough times. Ori Blundell and his wife came up with the idea as a way of making ends meet.
They're difficult times. People have to think what to do. And this is exactly what we thought of.
Business is brisk, but second-hand clothes are not going to save the nation. Iceland's natural resources might. As the economy contracts, many people are thinking about fish as a way out of the crisis. Stefan Alfsson is a currency trader who lost his job in the crash. He says you see images of fish every time you handle the country's coins.
Look at our poor currency. I mean, if you look at it, the coins, what do you see? You all pictures of fish on it. I mean, it's so deep in the culture and the definition of who we are as a nation.
Stefan was a fisherman. At 23, he was Iceland's youngest skipper. Then he left to take a business degree and eventually became a currency trader. Now his financial career is over. Stefan is thinking of going back to sea.
We have one of the best fishing grounds in the world. We always come back to this. I mean, it is what we know best. Probably it's at least in part what will get us out of this crisis.
Fishing still accounts for 70% of export earnings and 10% of GDP, but it's difficult to see how this industry could expand without damaging the country's carefully conserved fish stocks. Iceland could fall back on its other great natural resource, low-cost, non-polluting energy.
Here we have our geothermal turbines.
This power plant on a volcanic ridge not far from Reykjavik processes hot water and steam piped up from deep within the Earth's crust. Along with hydropower from its glaciers, Iceland can generate vast amounts of cheap green electricity. Already it drives virtually everything in the country except transport. If all vehicles could be converted to run on electric or hydrogen power, Iceland could become a model for the 21st century, the world's first fossil fuel-free country. John Born Skulason of Icelandic New Energy.
We can be self-sufficient with energy. We don't have to spend a lot of valuable foreign currency to import fossil fuels. And if we can electrify the economy, of course, that will have a big impact on the economic life of Iceland. And that's the beautiful future.
A future that's probably at least 10 years away. In the meantime, given the grim reality of the present, anything's worth a shot, like this computer game.
This is live footage of the Rebels' border in Solitude, where Imperial Navy worships...
EVE Online is a multiple-player game developed in Iceland. It's growing fast. More than 250,000 people worldwide are now taking part. It was created here by programmers who lost their jobs in the dot-com crash, a sign perhaps that Icelanders can and do bounce back. In Reykjavik, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
We spend a lot of time on this broadcast bringing you the big business stories, except for the next minute and a half, during which time our own Rico Galliano and Brendan Noonan will quiz the Marketplace staff to find out about this week's, well, let's just call them... colorful stories. The stuff you might want to talk about at a dinner party this weekend.
Stacey Vanek Smith, senior reporter at Marketplace. What are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Food auctions.
What is a food auction?
Well, it's just like an art auction, except they're selling big quantities of damaged food.
7,000 pounds of bratwurst to the gentleman on the phone.
Yeah, it's not exactly like your Sotheby's Picasso auction because, you know, this guy in Pennsylvania started getting this food from supermarkets that they were tossing, and he's selling all this food to people whose grocery bills have gone up because food inflation is so high and nobody has a job.
Auctions which once sold great art, they're now selling stale bread.
Oh, yeah. Last year it was all about the paintings of cans of Campbell soup, and this year it's the actual cans of Campbell soup.
Jeremy Hobson, reporter, what is your story?
Well, it turns out if you're looking for a job, the place to go is back to school because college towns have some of the lowest unemployment rates in the country.
Really? Like how low?
Ames, Iowa, where Iowa State University has a 3.8% rate. Keep in mind the national unemployment rate is 8.5%.
So are there professional beer pong leagues now or something?
Maybe everybody's getting out of town after they've embarrassed themselves with a midnight streak on the quad and they're leaving all those jobs open. The possibilities are endless.
Phyllis Owens, commentary editor for Marketplace, what's your story?
Well, the second California gold rush is on. A few hours outside of Los Angeles, they're panning for gold.
Are you serious?
Yes, and guess what? They're finding it.
What's going on?
Apparently, during the gold rush, something like 80% of the gold was never uncovered. So people are really finding money there.
So what are we doing here right now?
My point exactly.
Let's get out of here.
That is just a taste of Rico and Brendan's podcast. They call it the Dinner Party Download. Let us know what you think of it and everything else you hear on the broadcast. You can find a link at marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Friday. Today, the Dow dropped 1.8%, 148 points, closed at 7,776. The NASDAQ lost 2.6%, 41 points, finished at 1545. The S&P 500 fell 2%, 16 points, ended the day at 815. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer of the program is J.J. York. Coming up on Monday, high school seniors are thinking twice about spending big on college.
A lot of my friends, they're getting to schools that they really wanted to go to, but then like when they think about the money, they're like, this is unrealistic. I'm probably not going here.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.